Bók Forlagið Stólpa presents Liberty, The Evolution of an Idea, edited by Kurt Almqvist, Alistair Benn, and Matthias Heiserus, and read by Helen Lloyd. Fighting Against the Odds, Rob Johnson. The best people possess a feeling for beauty, the courage to take risks, the discipline to tell the truth, and the capacity for sacrifice. Ironically, their virtues make them vulnerable. They're often wounded, sometimes destroyed. Ernest Hemingway. One of the enduring paradoxes of the human condition is why, when success and survival appear impossible, men and women fight on for a liberty they will not live to see. It was recognized as early as 4 BC in Sun Tzu's The Art of War, and has reappeared throughout history, most recently in the Ukraine conflict. The odds are at their most extreme for irregular fighters and partisans when faced with the overwhelming strength of regular armies, intent on their destruction. Yet there are episodes when those who would support the apparently hopeless cause of liberty outside the zone of conflict wish to assist these desperate fighters. Sometimes individuals set off to fight, inspired by a common cause, such as the young men and women from across Europe and America, including Ernest Hemingway, who chose to join the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-39. Despite the romantics and idealists, the most effective form of external assistance has been the full mobilization of armed forces that come to fight alongside the partisans. But there have been other, more clandestine methods of support too. Special operational forces backed by naval interdiction, the transmission of funds, equipment and munitions have been used to balance the odds in favor of the partisans of liberty. On 24th of February 2022, more than 200,000 Russian armed forces made an illegal and unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. Attempting to seize the capital, Kyiv, with an audacious air assault, the main body of ground forces were supposed to drive over the Ukrainian forces with speed and superior mass. But the initial assault failed for two reasons. Primarily, it was down to determined and astonishingly courageous Ukrainian resistance. But it was also in part due to the provision of Western intelligence on the direction, weight, and timing of the Russian attack. As the Russian offensive stalled, the Kremlin's original planning assumptions had to be revised. They had not expected such stiff resistance. We know this because there was a leak of the intended Russian victory announcement by the media company RIA Novosti, indicating that President Putin expected to have taken Kyiv in just 3 days. For a few weeks, Putin must have ordered his forces to press on, but the logistical chain, stretched as it was, began to break down. North of Kyiv, a vast column of vehicles and troops became stationary, ripe targets for bold Ukrainian special forces, who raided their fixed enemy with drones and Western-manufactured anti-tank weapons. Elsewhere, Ukrainian troops had been dispersed and fought from forested or suburban locations. They remained concealed, struck their adversaries and vanished quickly into the landscape, replicating the MOTI tactics used by Finland in the Winter War of 1939 against the Soviets. The Ukrainian success in destroying columns of Russian armour with the West's anti-tank guided weapon systems soon made Javelin and N-Law familiar terms in the global media. The Ukrainians also made extensive and adroit use of social media to capture footage of their tactical victories. Soon, video clips of exploding Russian tanks, burned-out armoured personnel carriers, abandoned or blasted trucks, all with that familiar Z motif which the Russians used for identification purposes, became legion. Once again, the Russian reputation for using manipulative disinformation had been anticipated and amplified by the platforms of the media. The Kremlin's messaging was overwhelmed by the Ukrainian narrative of heroic self-defense. Exasperated by the attacks from unseen enemies and with contempt for the Ukrainian people, Russian troops began to inflict reprisals on civilians. The Russian authorities had spread the lie that Ukrainians were neo-Nazis, infected with unwholesome Western thinking, which had somehow led them from the truth that they were really Russians. The Kremlin's line was that the invasion was really a liberation. Young Russian men, bewildered by the higher standard of living of those they now occupied and by the resistance they faced, took to looting and vandalism. Empowered with weapons and the encouragement of their commanders, some tortured, raped, and murdered at will. When the Russians were driven back from settlements north of Kyiv and Kharkiv, evidence emerged of the abuse. Random shootings of citizens in the street, a young woman branded on her back with a large Z, and individuals deliberately crushed under a tank. Ukrainians, therefore, concluded that this was an existential war. Inspired by President Zelensky's resolve and willingness to be exposed to danger himself, Ukrainians found various ways to resist. Older women handed packets of sunflower seeds to Russian occupiers with the assurance that, when they died, sunflowers, the national symbol of Ukraine, would grow where they fell. Householders threw Molotov cocktails from balconies and windows onto Russian armoured vehicles passing through the streets. Teenagers equipped Ukrainian soldiers with drones to provide tactical surveillance on Russian movements. This was a nationwide resistance movement. The Western countries had tried to deter Russia from the invasion. They had warned of unprecedented sanctions and made repeated diplomatic warnings. Putin ignored them. He had prepared thoroughly. He felt that, in time, the Europeans' dependence on Russian hydrocarbons would make the West compliant. He was confident in Russian military strength after years of building up his forces, of the prowess of his army following large-scale exercises, and, as he liked to remind the West, of Russia's extensive nuclear arsenal. The Kremlin threatened nuclear retaliation if NATO intervened. It ridiculed Western leaders, appealed to the developing world as a champion of decent values against the West's overbearing decadence, and even claimed that NATO had expanded territorially at Russia's expense. And so this special military operation was no more than self-defense. The West chose not to intervene directly. NATO could not invoke Article 5, the activation of collective defense, because no member state had been attacked. The risk of Putin's nuclear escalation had to be considered too. Instead, the decision was taken to supply Ukraine with armaments, munitions, and intelligence. The initial supply was a little haphazard. The UK and the United States were generous in packages of funding and defensive weapons systems, such as anti-tank missiles. In the first 4 months, the US sent 7,000 Javelin projectiles. Nevertheless, the Ukrainians estimated they were using up to 500 missiles a day. In time, as Russia refused to halt its offensive, the Western contributions grew into large consignments of more offensive munitions, artillery ammunition, howitzers, and most significantly, HIMARS, the long-range rocket batteries. But European contributions were inconsistent. The German government, of Olaf Scholz, was anxious about breaking its established position of non-aggression, and tried to send only protective equipment, such as helmets and medical support. Eventually, Germany offered armoured vehicles. By contrast, countries that normally observed a neutral status, such as Sweden and Finland, sent war supplies. The Kremlin believed that the West was, to quote Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, engaged in a war with Russia through a proxy and is arming that proxy. In fact, the West had not yet decided on such a course of war with Russia. Its objective was to compel Russia to leave Ukraine through economic, financial, and logistical pressure. Arming the proxy was merely prudent. If Zelensky's administration received no aid, it was likely that Ukraine would be unable to sustain its resistance for more than a few weeks. The cost of the war to the Ukrainian economy was more than $5 billion per month, so financial backing was critical. Ukrainian soldiers had to be fed, supplied, armed, and equipped. Every day, the Russians fired long-range missiles into urban centres, hoping to destroy transport nodes, depots, and warehouses. Their destruction was also designed to demoralise the Ukrainian people and thus stir the desire for peace at any price. Civilian apartment blocks in particular were targeted, torn open and pulverized with depressing frequency. But the Ukrainian public picked up the pieces, wept for their losses, and continued to express their defiance of the orcs, as they labelled the Russians who were trying to take away their land and their liberty. Those hoping to gain a glimpse of how arming a war of liberty externally would pan out looked to history. The results appeared to be mixed. One of the most striking examples of success in the modern era is the American Revolution. For 4 years, there was limited progress militarily for the Americans, although politically, the war for freedom became an established and accepted element for the public. Crucially, when France joined the war, the British were forced to divert sparse manpower and ships to protect both the UK and the lucrative Caribbean. Denuded of forces, the British suffered a humiliating defeat at Yorktown in 1781 and never recovered. The combination of military assistance, training, and the presence of a French land and naval force had undoubtedly turned the tide in America's fortunes. External assistance did not always succeed, and could even end disastrously. General Charles Gordon had been dispatched by the British government to assist the Egyptians in the administration of Sudan in the 1870s, and he was asked to return to evacuate Egyptian personnel in 1884 in the face of a jihadist revolt. But when he arrived in Khartoum, he could not bring himself to abandon the city's inhabitants. Subsequently besieged by a vast jihadist force, he was at first convinced his government would come to the assistance of the people of Sudan. When it became evident the forces of liberation would not arrive in time, he chose not to escape, but to fight to the end. A relief column arrived 2 days too late to change the course of events, and it was clear that Gordon had been killed, along with his hungry and beleaguered garrison. The British government was brought down on the issue, but Sudan was simply abandoned in an ignominious scuttle. It was only recovered 13 years later. Its second governor was Reginald Wingate, a keen supporter of the Arabs and Sudanese who did much to rebuild a devastated region. Wingate's distant cousin was Thomas Edward Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia, and his fortunes were just as hazardous. Lawrence was dispatched willingly to Arabia in 1917 to act as a liaison officer to local leaders as part of an allied mission to assist the Bedouin to fight against the Ottoman authorities. Initially, Lawrence guided small bands of mounted Arab irregulars in raids against the Hejaz Railway, while the Royal Navy supplied the Arabs with munitions, rations and aircraft. Other British and French officers conducted training and led their own raids. Light artillery, with gunners from Egypt and North Africa, provided fire support, and by the end of the campaign, bombers, fighter aircraft and armoured cars accompanied the increasingly regularised Arab armies. Lawrence felt that British and French military assistance should be considered only as the enablers of a far more extensive campaign to liberate Arabs from Ottoman rule after the war. In this, he was largely successful, although there were episodes of unrest in the region when local populations felt the Allies had stayed too long. Lawrence was also aware of that dilemma of fighting for a liberty one might not live to enjoy. He was troubled by the expectation that others might have to die for the Allied war effort, but also the contradiction they might die for the cause of freedom itself and thus never experience it. In his desert campaign, he wrote that he was reluctant to put at risk his Arab fighters because only a man alive could taste liberty. Yet in his magisterial study of the war in Arabia in 1917-18, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he encounters dilemmas that complicate such a neat economy of risks. He was cornered south of Amman with his companions, and they resolved they would sell their lives dearly. He witnessed the self-sacrificial charge of the head man of the village of Sheikh Sa'ad, who had been incensed by Ottoman atrocities against civilians, and he himself gambled with his life when operations went awry in the Jordan Valley in November 1917. Lawrence's account, like so many memoirs of war, exposes an enduring paradox. Why, when success and survival are so unlikely, men and women fight on for a liberty they will not live to taste? The decision to fight on, when destruction is certain, was recognized by Sun Tzu in The Art of War. He cautioned that one should avoid the complete envelopment of a cornered adversary to prevent his continued resistance from a position of despair. It suggests desperate men fighting without fear could inflict disproportionate damage and perhaps even turn the tide of a battle. Those with their backs against the wall have nothing to lose. The desperate nature of their situation produces its own energy and motivation. Some situations, therefore, create the circumstances where there is no choice but to fight to the death, although these tend to be short-lived. Ukraine has a rich history of resistance. Partisans took on the Red Army in the Russian Civil War, using forests to conceal their communities. As the communists approached over the steppes in 1920, early warning was given to small mobile groups of fighters who progressively picked off the red columns, then disappeared into the dense undergrowth. In the Second World War, Ukraine was overrun for a second time by Nazi occupation, but once again, there was a strong desire to survive and resist, and some Ukrainians sided with Germany in the vain hope of assistance towards independence. Polish and Jewish populations faced even greater odds. Here, the very existence of the people was under threat by the Nazi regime. While millions perished in concentration camps and slave labour conditions, some organised a last-ditch resistance from rural areas. In Warsaw, in 1944, the Polish Home Army, expecting imminent liberation by the Soviets, launched their bid for freedom. For weeks, they battled Nazi forces, but Stalin deliberately held back the Soviet forces that could have saved them. He calculated that the Nazis would wipe out the Polish leadership, and he would then be able to impose his own occupation without resistance thereafter. More than 200,000 Polish personnel were killed during the failed rising. The Allies were simply too far away to offer any meaningful support, and the small number of Anglo-Polish relief flights that were mounted were even attacked by Soviet aircraft. Elsewhere, the Allies were able to make a significant effort to support resistance movements in the Second World War, setting a precedent for the decades that followed. Specially trained personnel were first infiltrated by the British by land, sea and air into occupied Europe and Japanese-controlled parts of Asia, through the organisation known as Special Operations Executive, SOE. Established in June 1940, when invasion seemed imminent and there was a requirement for special commando units that could provide the nucleus of a resistance movement should Britain be occupied, the force was later redesigned to project force into Europe. Winston Churchill had demanded an organisation to set Europe ablaze. He believed strongly that if aided by Britain, Europeans would be willing to form their own resistance organisations. He imagined that in time, British and American forces would land in Europe and link up with these well-equipped partisans to liberate the continent. A similar campaign would sweep the Japanese out of Eastern Asia. A range of operations were conducted, from small-scale sabotage in the Netherlands to the mobilisation of guerrilla armies in Yugoslavia. But it all proved much harder to implement than anyone had anticipated. In France alone, before 1944, some 104 agents were killed in action, caught and executed or died of their injuries. The numbers lost across Europe were proportionately high, but shrouded in secrecy at the time. The fate of some is still unknown. An estimated total of 13,000 personnel served in SOE, of whom approximately 3,000 were women. But the result of SOE operations, from Albania to China, was that the Allies enabled the liberation of Europe and Asia and ensured that sovereignty was restored after 1945. Only in the Soviet sphere were national and liberal resistance movements subsequently suppressed. This suggests that democracies are far more likely to aim for genuine liberation through their support of proxies, while authoritarian regimes may use them for the advancement of their own cynical interests, but they are unlikely to be tolerated after they have served their purpose. The history of external support to local forces, both regular and irregular, therefore produces some important considerations. What are the deductions? The chief requirement for the exogenous supporting power is legitimacy. Offering external support to a polity, a movement, or a resistance organization that lacks public support or legitimacy is doomed to failure. Even if military successes can be achieved, the lack of political consent will mean there will be no lasting foundations of support. This was the case with the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan between 2002 and 2021. Its repeated failures, endemic corruption, and the evident fact that it only existed because of the backing of the American-led coalition eroded its legitimacy to the point where few Afghans supported it. Its enemies, the Taliban and other anti-government factions, enjoyed more support because of their discipline, Islamist credentials, and reputation for enforcing security at a local level. The second insight is that only highly trained personnel, familiar with the terrain, the people, and the skills required for special operations, can be deployed with any expectation of success. Each operation has to adhere to a well-crafted plan, accompanied by adroit messaging to the public, since indiscriminate violence and reprisals will alienate the people. These trained personnel are also the most appropriate to utilize remotely operated munitions, such as mines, electronic warfare, satellite communications, and uncrewed aerial vehicles. Close-quarter assassinations are high risk and would be rare, not only to reduce the risk to limited numbers of operatives, but also to protect the people from vindictive occupation forces. Trained personnel will know the importance of changing tactics and targets on a frequent basis to avoid setting patterns. Given the degree of surveillance available to states, the number of attacks in any given period has to be calculated against the increased profile, and therefore risk of detection they produce. If the area of operation is too limited, it would not take an occupation force long to cordon and comb out a small area. Hoaxes and deception measures are vital for the survival of operators, and they can elicit a large volume of data on the practices of any occupation force. These patterns can be studied and exploited by partisans with great effect, specifically to avoid detection or to mount attacks. To avoid compromise, the recruitment of local partisans also requires certain skills. Recruits have to be selected, usually by trusted authorities, and tested and inoculated with missions progressively, only proceeding to the most challenging and high-risk tasks once they are proven on those that are easier. Cells of partisans have to be unknown to each other to avoid hostile intelligence or captured partisans giving away details of other groups under torture. Operators and partisan leaders have to spend as much time on education and planning as they can spare, and far more than on actual missions, probably at a ratio of 3-1. A counterintelligence team is also crucial, with tests, surveillance, and frequent changes of identity, passwords, and codes to avoid penetration and betrayal. Specialists are needed for explosives, medical treatment, and communications. All these lessons were learned the hard way, often through bitter experience, by SOE and the Office of Strategic Services, the organization set up by the Americans. Historical cases also indicate that external authorities need a clear objective and a strong sense of local needs. At the government level, there has to be international recognition of the resistance. In the Second World War, governments in exile were supported by the United Kingdom in order to maintain their legitimacy. Their VIPs were accorded high levels of security, provided with intelligence, and invited to work as equals in Allied planning. With the Polish government, this worked well, but relations with the French under Charles de Gaulle were more fractious because of his insistence on independent decisions. Nevertheless, this joint planning proved vital, from the coordination of refugees and their welfare to the acquisition of local intelligence and the positioning of Allied resources. The British enabled the governments in exile to maintain communication with their occupied populations through radio broadcasts. The widespread use of the V symbol in sound and in physical form acted as an encouragement to those living under the Nazis, and it allowed everyone to participate. Wrapping out the V in Morse code or daubing walls with the letter let others know the allegiance to resistance. Radio also provided coded messages which could be picked up and used by resistance operators. The resistance demands for armaments and munitions and the means of covert transportation require high levels of organization and security. Western military and financial support to Ukraine in 2022 was significant. Before the conflict, Ukrainians had received military training teams, financial packages, and some military equipment. Between the Russian invasion in February 2022 and August, the United States had sent $8.2 billion, over half of which was in the form of military assistance, the rest humanitarian. The UK had committed $1 billion of military and civil aid, and the EU €6 billion, mainly as financial assistance. The sheer volume of munitions required came as a surprise to the Western states, as they had grown used to relatively low expenditures of ammunition against insurgents and a long period of peace. The sudden demands of large-scale industrialized warfare meant a rapid increase in production. The United States, nevertheless, rose to the occasion as the arsenal of democracy. In the spring of 2022, it had sent 1,400 Stinger anti-aircraft systems, 11,600 anti-tank weapons, 100 tactical unmanned aerial systems or drones, more than 300 grenade launchers, 5,000 rifles, 1,000 pistols, and 600 machine guns, with 60 million rounds of small arms ammunition, grenades and mortar rounds. It sent over 1 million rounds of artillery ammunition. The US also provided 5 Mi-17 helicopters, 3 patrol boats, and 70 high-mobility multi-purpose wheeled vehicles, better known as Humvees. To protect Ukrainian personnel, the Americans dispatched counter-artillery and counter-unmanned aerial system tracking radars, counter-mortar radar systems, 25,000 sets of body armor and 25,000 helmets. They sent medical equipment to support treatment and combat evacuation, explosive ordnance disposal and demining equipment and satellite imagery and analysis tools. The private sector joined in too. Elon Musk, the American entrepreneur, established a secure satellite communication system known as Starlink for the Ukrainians to use. As the conflict in Ukraine has continued, there are inevitably consequences for the West. Russia imposed limitations on the supply of oil and gas before cutting them off entirely. It blockaded Ukrainian ports, denying millions access to grain supplies, until Russia suffered a heavy loss in warships to missile strikes. Some in the West questioned the economic cost of the war, although the majority believed the cause justified the expense. The case for supporting resistance in another state is ultimately a moral one. There is something deeply inspirational about humans struggling for liberty. The desire to be free of oppression and servitude is strong, even where the sacrifice it requires can be morally troubling. To willingly die in the service of the freedom of others is an ultimate act. It is moving, poignant, and final. Yet paradoxically, it is not quite so final as it seems. A sacrifice, such as the last-ditch defense of Snake Island and Mariupol by Ukrainian soldiers and reservists, gives direction, leadership, and a measure to the depth of the cause. Those who cannot taste liberty by their sacrifice have, in fact, laid the path that enables others to do so. Not all agree. Sir John Keegan criticized the legacy of SOE, arguing that it had spawned modern terrorism. The justification for SOE operations at the time and since, he stated, are exactly those used by terrorist organizations. But this cannot be true. There is a significant moral difference in sustaining resistance against an illegal and immoral invasion or existential attack such as Russia's or Nazi Germany's and the ideological wars of choice pursued by terrorists. Most terror organizations do not seek liberation and care little for public consent except to serve their claims to legitimacy. Many terror groups will claim to be acting on behalf of the people, or, as in the case of jihadist groups, in the name of God. Their real objective is usually far more limited. These claims are in contrast to true moral causes, such as that of Gordon of Khartoum, who was motivated by genuine altruism and expected moral support against slavery and oppression. Those who fight for national survival might equally expect empathy and see a moral obligation to weaken an oppressive power where the means exist and where their values are founded on principles of liberty of the people, the characteristics of Lawrence of Arabia and Winston Churchill. In 2022, that was also true of Volodymyr Zelensky. An examination of the liberation leaders and the nameless fighters who sacrifice themselves, or those who choose to support the cause of liberty as external agents, gives us a glimpse of the sacrifices that are required for liberty. Those who serve that purpose are, ultimately, the best people, just as Hemingway suggested.